Henry VIII is the most married king in British history, famously clocking up a total of 6 brides before his eventual death in January 1547. These 6 women, Catherine of Aragon, Anne Boleyn, Jane Seymour, Anne of Cleves, Catherine Howard, and Catherine Parr, all shared the same destiny, to be married to King Henry VIII, but to varying degrees of longevity, significance, and success. Each would, in her own way, define a period of Henry VIII's life and have become 6 of the most famous women in British history. But, due to the nature of Henry VIII's tumultuous reign and contrary personality, the success the 6 wives enjoyed, both in their lifetime and ever since, has fluctuated, changed with the times, and should be viewed with a massive dollop of hindsight. If we were to speak to King Henry VIII whilst he was alive and ask him who he would call his most successful, I suspect that the answer would be quite different were we able to appraise him of all of the facts that came after his death. So who then was the most successful of Henry VIII's wives? Is it even possible to name one? What are the parameters for defining success? Was it the devoted Catherine of Aragon or the tempestuous Anne Boleyn? The meek Jane Seymour or the sensible Anne of Cleves? Could it be the teenage Catherine Howard or the brave Catherine Parr? Well, today I will try and answer that question, so stay tuned to find out. Welcome back to the Tudor Chess Podcast, episode 36. Who was the most successful of King Henry VIII's wives? One of the first things to consider when assessing the overall success of Henry VIII's wives is to look at the longevity of the marriages in question. On this point alone, Catherine of Aragon reigns supreme, being married to the king for more than double the amount of time that the remaining 5 queens were married to the king put together. Catherine was Henry VIII's first queen and would be by his side for 23 years, 11 months and 12 days. By contrast, Anne Boleyn reigned as queen for 2 years, 11 months and 19 days, a little over 1,000 days. Jane Seymour was queen for 1 year, 4 months and 24 days. Anna of Cleves was married to the king for 6 months and 6 days. Catherine Howard for 1 year, 6 months and 16 days. And Catherine Parr for 3 years, 6 months and 16 days. Although this final marriage could have gone on longer had it not been for the king's own death. In short, the final 5 wives of Henry VIII were by his side for a combined total window of less than 10 years, compared to the nearly 24 years that Catherine of Aragon was Henry VIII's wife. If we're basing things purely on the length of time alone, as I've said, then it's a done deal. Catherine of Aragon wins. But there is much more to explore here. How did the queens fare when it came to their duties as a queen consort? I will not start with childbirth, but with the equally traditional queenly task of charitable work and alms. Each of Henry VIII's wives were expected, as queen, to give funds to charity and to carry out a large amount of good works and charitable engagements, much like the modern royal family still do today. It was also the custom for royal wives at the time to intercede on behalf of those suffering punishment, with the hopeful outcome of ensuring acquittal for the condemned. Also mirroring the modern day way in which royals will champion particular causes, so was the case with the 6 wives of Henry VIII, who would focus on areas that they felt most affinity towards. We do not have extensive amounts of information available to us on how each of Henry VIII's queens chose to engage in the charity sector, although information is certainly there for the queens more well known or politically active in their time. Anne Boleyn and Catherine Parr were definitely the most progressively minded of Henry's queens and duly set up charitable endeavours and gave funds to projects which aligned with their respective beliefs in religious reform, providing support for the poor and patronages of the arts. Anne Boleyn's commitment to helping the poor is one of the defining characteristics of her tenure as queen, but is largely overlooked in place of the more salacious stories that centred around her. It has been claimed that Anne Boleyn gave away around £15,000 a year in charitable donation. That is the equivalent of around £7 million by modern standards. Anne's commitment to charity work was commented on significantly by her contemporaries. For example, William Latimer, one of Anne's chaplains, said of Anne following the traditional Maundy Thursday service, "She commanded me to put privily into every poor woman's purse one golden noble, the which was 6 shillings 8 pence over, and besides the alms that wanted to be given." John Fox would also write of Anne's generosity, stating, "How bountiful she was to the poor, passing not only the common example of other queens, but also the revenues almost of her estate, insomuch that the alms which she gave in 3/4 of a year in distribution is summed to the number of £14,000 or £15,000, besides the great piece of money which her grace intended to impart into 4 sundry quarters of the realm." Anne was also famously committed to religious reform, championing the translation of the Bible into English, believing that the Word of God should be accessible to all, or not only those who read and understood Latin. A key factor in the fissure which developed in the relationship between Thomas Cromwell and Anne Boleyn was in the way in which revenues drawn from the dissolution of the monasteries would be spent, with Thomas Cromwell keen for it to line the king's coffers, whilst Queen Anne hoped that it would be used in the establishment of new centres of education and to alleviate the pressures the poor faced. This latter point was particularly significant, as the monasteries were a crucial means of providing support to the poor, giving them food and warmth in the winter and so on, and so with their disestablishment, it in effect made the poor poorer. The amount of money that Anne gave away cannot be underestimated, with some historians suggesting that she actually gave away more money to charity across her almost 3 years of marriage to the king than Catherine of Aragon did over nearly 24 years. Now, this isn't to say that Catherine of Aragon did not give considerably to the poor. She absolutely did. She performed the expected duties, such as washing poor women's feet and providing alms on Maundy Thursday. But given Catherine's lifelong position as a Princess of Spain and then Queen of England, she was perhaps less aware or perhaps underestimated the stark difference in how she lived compared to your average Tudor, which Anne, although well-born, would have been more consciously aware of. Unlike Anne Boleyn, Catherine was also not a religious reformer, remaining staunch in her views of the traditional Catholic faith till the day of her death, and would not have championed the common cause to make religion more accessible in the way that Anne Boleyn did. Anne Boleyn's decision to involve herself in extensive charitable work, as I referenced earlier, brought her into conflict with Thomas Cromwell's policies. Anne's desire for change made her a political figure, which in many respects aided her eventual downfall. It is unsurprising, therefore, that little exists by way of information about Jane Seymour's charitable endeavours. This was a queen who would remain politically neutral, or more accurately, parrot the words of her husband. One aspect of Jane's tenure as queen was her desire for reconciliation between Henry VIII and his daughters, particularly his elder daughter, the Lady Mary, with her showing such favour to her elder stepdaughter that the king once famously scolded Jane, telling her that she should focus on providing him with a son and not the interests of his wayward daughter. What we do know is that, like Catherine of Aragon, Jane Seymour was religiously conservative, and as such would not have championed religious reform in the way that Anne Boleyn did. Given the brevity of Anna of Cleves' marriage to the king, there is also little by way of information available to us on what kind of charity work she did. Her successor, Catherine Howard, despite the infamy of her fall which surrounds her story, actually conducted her queenly duties with relative aplomb, receiving considerable praise for her conduct during the progress that she and Henry VIII made to the north of England in 1451. Although we do not have extensive information available to us about how much charity work Catherine Howard did, or the money that she freely gave away, she was clearly charitable in her personality, as evidenced by her decision to send Margaret Pole, the aged Countess of Salisbury, a large number of expensive items of clothing, including furred nightgowns, during Margaret's imprisonment in the Tower, which shows a caring and charitable side quite at odds with the flighty young woman that history so repeatedly paints Catherine Howard to be. Henry VIII's final queen, Catherine Parr, was, as I said earlier, alongside Anne Boleyn, the most committed of Henry VIII's wives when it came to religious reform. In fact, she far exceeded Anne Boleyn in this fact, for although Anne Boleyn would never have considered herself a Protestant, Catherine Parr most certainly did. In fact, such was her conviction in the reformers' faith that it brought her tantalisingly close to suffering the same fate as Anne Boleyn and Catherine Howard. In 1546, her enemies, including the anti-Protestant clergyman Stephen Gardiner, found the king tiring of Catherine's religious talk and persuaded him to sign a warrant for her arrest. Catherine famously found out about the plan and managed to intercede the king, which ultimately managed to save her life, giving Catherine the last laugh. She was also as equally committed to education and may have been instrumental in the construction of Trinity College at Oxford University. Catherine was a keen patron of the arts and championed the role of women in a way none of her predecessors had. She was, for example, the first woman in English history to publish a book in English in her own name and maintained close relationships with both leading lights of the Protestant Reformation and grassroots figures such as Anne Askew. So from a charitable endeavours perspective, who stands out the most? Well, for me, it's Anne Boleyn. That so many of her contemporaries commented on her commitment to aiding the poor in particular tells us that this was clearly something Anne was very passionate about. She was easily the most slandered of Henry VIII's wives, viewed as scandalous by large swathes of the nobility and common people, and yet if the records are to be believed, Anne put this aside and used her position as the most powerful woman in England during her short reign to do as much as she could for those with less, even if the people that she was helping favoured her predecessor. That Anne Boleyn fell out so significantly with Thomas Cromwell, and that it's well documented that the way funds would be used following the dissolution of the monasteries was the basis for their falling out, tells us quite clearly that Anne's desire for the betterment on behalf of the poor was not feigned, but something that she was clearly committed to. When it comes to childbirth, on the face of it, none of Henry VIII's wives were especially successful, at least in the crudest sense. And it was the lack of success in producing healthy male heirs that ultimately sealed the fate of both Catherine of Aragon and Anne Boleyn. Catherine of Aragon will fall pregnant by the king a recorded 6 times. Her first pregnancy resulted in the miscarriage of a baby girl at 6 months gestation on the 31st of January 1510. The Queen's doctors believed that she was actually carrying twins, and so the loss of her baby was kept secret until the second child would be born. When no baby turned up, the loss of the Queen's first child was then revealed. The following January, Catherine was safely delivered of a boy, and all looked well. He was called Henry, but sadly, he died 6 weeks later with no recorded cause of death. In 1513 and 1514, Catherine miscarried 2 further times, with both children supposedly being boys, before the birth of a 5th child, Mary, in 1516. This young girl would famously be the only of Catherine's children to outreach childhood, growing up to be the first Queen Regnant to rule England in her own right, as Queen Mary I. Catherine's final pregnancy resulted in the birth of a stillborn daughter in 1518. It was Catherine's inability to provide a healthy male heir that entirely defined Henry VIII's desire to part from her. The Tudor dynasty was still relatively new, and as the family boasted only tenuous rights to the throne in the first place, the need for a male heir was, to Henry's mind, the single most important duty that he and his queen had to perform for the stability of their realm. When it became clear that Catherine would not provide Henry VIII with his much-desired male heir, that is when the king began the process for an annulment of their marriage and in turn allow him to marry Anne Boleyn. Henry VIII and Anne Boleyn were officially married on the 25th of January 1533, by which time Anne was already pregnant. She went into labour in the first few days of September 1533 and gave birth to her first child on the 7th of September. But famously, she had done no better than her predecessor, for the child born to Anne Boleyn was a girl, Elizabeth. Henry VIII styled his disappointment out, noting that he and Anne were still young and that boys would now follow. Exactly how many further pregnancies Anne Boleyn had remains a contentious subject. There is no doubt that there were at least 2 more pregnancies, although some historians believe that Anne was pregnant on 4 occasions. It is the second pregnancy that is the one which remains unclear, but if the records from Eustace Chapuis are to be believed, Anne either miscarried or believed that she was pregnant but wasn't over the Christmas period of 1534. At some point in 1535, Anne miscarried of a son, and on the 29th of January 1536, she suffered her final and catastrophic miscarriage, with the baby far along enough for midwives to confirm that it was male. The 29th of January 1536 was significant, for it was also the day that Catherine of Aragon was laid to rest. With the tragedy of this final pregnancy ending in disaster, Anne Boleyn's uncle, the Duke of Norfolk, commented that she miscarried of her saviour. Just 4 months later, Anne Boleyn would become the first queen in English history to be executed on charges of adultery, incest, and conspiring the king's death. Charges which were, as we now know, all nonsense. Her biggest crime to Henry VIII was that she had not upheld her promise and provided him with the sons that he so desperately craved. It was Anne Boleyn's successor, Jane Seymour, who finally gave the king his much-desired male heir. The marriage between Henry and Jane came just 11 days after Anne Boleyn's execution, but it was several months before the third of Henry's queens would fall pregnant. Her labour would be long and arduous, but end in triumph when on the 12th of October 1537 she gave birth to a healthy male heir. Finally, 28 years after ascending the throne, Henry VIII had his prince. Alas, whilst the young boy thrived, his mother did not, and within a fortnight Jane Seymour was dead, likely from either puerperal fever or an infection from retained placenta. There are no recorded pregnancies from any of Henry's final three wives, despite Catherine Howard in particular being young and thus more fertile, which leads many to conclude that by this point the king's expanding girth and breakdown in his once fine health led to impotence. So in the sense of childbirth, who was the most successful queen? Well, to answer that, we need to consider two things. Who was the most successful where it mattered at the time, and who provided the greatest legacy? These points are of equal importance when weighing things up. The simple answer is generally always Jane Seymour, for she gave King Henry VIII a son, which for Henry VIII ultimately was all that mattered. And this is broadly true. If we could time travel back to when Henry VIII was reaching the end of his life and ask him, which of your queens was the most successful in providing you with an heir, the obvious and only answer the king could have countenanced would have been Jane Seymour. But Henry VIII would have been speaking without the benefit of hindsight, not knowing that his precious son would indeed succeed him as king, but die at the age of 15, leaving behind a relatively inconsequential legacy. Were we able to have a conversation with Henry VIII now and tell him about the incredible success of his second daughter, Elizabeth, the child he deemed least important, then it's likely that the king would have to concede that it was Anne Boleyn who provided him with his most successful and strongest successor, which by extension could be argued makes Anne the most successful in terms of producing a healthy child, given that Elizabeth reached a far greater age than both her siblings, her father, and her paternal grandfather, Henry VII. The wife of King Henry VIII, who is most consistently regarded as the least successful, is the fourth, Anna of Cleves, but this is based on the brevity of their marriage, which was comfortably the shortest of Henry's six unions, and the fact that Henry VIII was said to be so repulsed by Anna. This latter fact, however, is more of a modern invention, and whilst it's true that the king was said to have not been entirely happy with Anna, there is zero contemporary evidence to support the theory that he referred to her as a Flanders mare and that he felt she was particularly ugly. In fact, many historians are now beginning to fully reassess Anna's time on earth, with some concluding that in the end, she would become Henry's most successful wife. If we're basing this off their marriage, then that conclusion is massively wrong, for hers and Henry's marriage was undoubtedly the least successful. But it was Anna's life after her separation from the king that changes the way that we view her, and the idea that ultimately she had the last laugh. This is what underpins the theory that she was his most successful queen. In agreeing to a separation from the king without fuss, Anna was richly rewarded. She was given Hever Castle and Richmond Palace as residences, plus several others, a large annual income, and the king made her his legal sister, which meant that she retained royal rank. She maintained strong relationships with practically everyone in the English court, and also developed a strong bond with both of her stepdaughters. Her willingness to comply with the wishes of the king may not be viewed as an act of defiant feminist strength, but undoubtedly ensured a happy retirement from court. While the king lived, Anna would continue to live a luxurious lifestyle, but this all changed when the king died and Edward VI ascended the throne. He saw little reason to justify Anna's continued royal favour and massively curtailed the revenues that she received. This would change marginally during the opening phases of the reign of Queen Mary I, for Anna would join both the Queen and Princess Elizabeth in the carriage procession to the Queen's coronation, being officially recognised as the third lady in the kingdom. But the idea that her life was one of constant parties and intense luxury for the rest of her days is largely inaccurate. She certainly did well out of her separation from Henry VIII, but she would never remarry or have children, nor did she return to her native Cleves. Heather Darcy, a historian and expert in Anna's story, told me not long ago that we should not view Anna's story as one of her having the last laugh, but that in many respects Anna's later life, whilst comfortable, also placed her very much on the periphery. Heather Darcy believes that Anna would have felt lost and without purpose, and so whilst it's true that she enjoyed a much better outcome from her marriage to Henry VIII than most of his wives, it isn't totally accurate to therefore name her his most successful. I think it's fair to say that Catherine Howard has no chances of being named Henry VIII's most successful wife, because the aspects on which we judge success are by and large missing from Catherine's story and character. As I referenced earlier, there is evidence that she conducted the duties required of her well, with both her biographers Gareth Russell and Connor Byrne detailing moments in which Catherine rose to the challenge that her role dictated, showing excellent skill in the more traditionally female Tudor accomplishments of hospitality, dancing, and making merry. But because her marriage was relatively short-lived and ended the way it did, Catherine's mark on history is much more difficult to pin down than, say, that of Catherine of Aragon or Anne Boleyn. The relative obscurity of her early life is still a topic of much discussion. We don't know how old she was or what she really looked like, and this, coupled with her short-lived tenure as queen, has left Catherine Howard being Henry VIII's most mysterious and perhaps most misunderstood wife. As she carried no children and made no significant differences to the church or the Tudor society in which she briefly reigned, it is difficult to define what, if any, major successes she enjoyed. I believe she was a kind and caring young woman, as evidenced from the good deeds that she did, such as the earlier reference to her sending clothing to Margaret Pole, but these facts alone, whilst commendable, are not enough to place her in the same league as some of Henry VIII's other queens. Power is, of course, another definer of success. And although we tend to view Henry VIII's wives as lacking power, which in many respects they did, there were nonetheless occasions in which, by necessity, they had to rise up. And this is most overtly seen in Henry's first and last queens, for both Catherine of Aragon and Catherine Parr enjoyed periods of their marriage to the king in which they acted as regents of England, something Henry's four other queens would not experience. In both instances, the two Catherines did their duty to perfection and were complimented on their successes by Henry VIII. Although this praise did not extend so far as to accepting that female rule could be just as effective as male rule. Catherine of Aragon's time as regent came on the 11th of June 1513, when Henry VIII appointed her the titles Governor of the Realm and Captain General whilst he went to France on a military campaign. Whilst Henry VIII was on his campaign into France, the King of Scotland, James IV, would famously invade the north of England. And in this moment of danger, Catherine took charge of the war effort to repel the invading Scots. She wrote to towns, including Gloucester, asking them to muster lists of men able to serve as soldiers. The Scots invaded, and on the 3rd of September 1513, she ordered Thomas Lovell to raise an army in the Midlands counties. Catherine was issued with banners at Richmond on the 8th of September and rode north in full armour to address the troops, despite being heavily pregnant at the time. Victory was given to the English at the Battle of Flodden, and when news reached Catherine of her army's success, she sent a letter to Henry VIII along with a piece of the bloodied coat of King James IV of Scotland, who died in the battle, for Henry to use as a banner at the Siege of Tournai. Catherine's tenure as regent was deemed as a resounding success, but this soon faded when she miscarried, highlighting that for Henry VIII, his wife's success in ruling England in his place was nice and all that, but not nearly as important as giving him healthy sons. Catherine Parr's moment to flex true regal power came when Henry VIII went on his last campaign to France from July to September 1544, leaving Catherine behind as his regent. Catherine's regency council was made up of members of her husband's court, sympathetic to Catherine's own preferred policies, particularly around religion, with Thomas Cranmer, Archbishop of Canterbury, who also happened to be Catherine's uncle, having a key role, alongside Edward Seymour, another prominent reformer. With these close allies by her side, Catherine obtained effective control and was able to rule as she saw fit. She handled provision, finances and musters for Henry's French campaign. She signed 5 royal proclamations and maintained constant contact with her lieutenant in the Northern Marches, Lord Shrewsbury, over the complex and continually unstable situation with Scotland. It is thought that her actions as regent, together with her strength of character and noted dignity and later religious convictions, greatly influenced her stepdaughter Elizabeth, who put much of what she saw her stepmother do into her own queenship in time. Both Catherine of Aragon and Catherine Parr's times as regents of England and the successes they enjoyed are certainly noteworthy and go a long way to defining either queen as the most successful, but equally we should also factor in that their power was short-lived and by dint of their marriage. This isn't to minimise their successes, but we must always keep in mind that Henry VIII only named his wives as regents for the simple fact that it was a short-term thing. Officially, they were acting as guardians, not monarchs, and it is crucial that we keep this distinction in mind. There is, of course, another part of Catherine Parr's story to tell. As the famous jingle says, divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. And in that final word, survived, we have Catherine Parr's perceived triumph over the much-married, wife-beheading maniac that was Henry VIII. Whilst it is undoubtedly true that Catherine did not suffer the indignity of either divorce or decapitation, this shouldn't immediately make her be seen as the most successful of Henry's queens. She survived because Henry died. That shouldn't be seen as successful. Lucky, perhaps, but not successful. Anna of Cleves, for example, also lived and would go on to outlive Catherine Parr by 9 years and Henry VIII by a decade, whereas Catherine Parr followed the king to the grave just 18 months after his death. To label her the most successful wife just because the king kiffed it before she did reduces down her remarkable story, and actually what makes her one of the contenders for Henry VIII's most successful queen is not in her short-lived survival, but her championing of religious reform, her patronage of the arts, and the success of her period as regent of England. These are all compelling points, but alas, when weighed up against everything, do not, I believe, lead her to being deemed Henry's most successful wife. So who is? Well, as I've already made clear, we can discount Catherine Howard and realistically Anna of Cleves as well, leaving us with Catherine of Aragon, Anne Boleyn, and Jane Seymour. Each of these women, in one way or another, had huge successes as Queens of England, but one stands out, and that is Anne Boleyn. Anne's tenure as queen was not a big success, as evidenced by the fact that she ended her life on the executioner's scaffold. However, when we take a more macro view and assess both her cultural impact, her position as the instigator for the Reformation of England, for which the country of the United Kingdom is still Protestant, the religion of the monarchy is Protestantism, her commitment to aiding the poor, and most significantly in her giving birth to what many view to be the greatest monarch in British history, Queen Elizabeth I, Anne Boleyn has a legacy which all of Henry VIII's other wives cannot lay claim to. Although she died, officially, a traitor to the crown, she left behind a daughter for whom an entire period of history is named after, and whilst Henry VIII will be spinning in his grave at the thought of it, Anne's global popularity is what ultimately defines her as the most successful of Henry's queens. We have to view all of the facts as one, and when viewed as one, it is Anne who repeatedly comes out on top, which is why I believe that on balance, although she and the king would never have thought it possible, that she was, and is, Henry VIII's most successful queen. And so that brings me to the end of this week's episode of the Tudor Chess Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Tomorrow, exclusively on my Patreon account, I'm speaking to Dr. Estelle Paranac on my Historian Unwrapped series. I discover how Estelle started out as a historian, some of her Tudor opinions, and who her dream Tudor dinner party guests would be. To access this and all other subscriber content from the Tudor Chest, just head to patreon.com/thetudorchest. Thank you again, and speak soon.